Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. We'll be checking in with Adam Boileau in just a moment and talking through all the week's security news, and then we'll be hearing from two guests in this week's sponsor interview. This week's show is brought to you by Attack IQ and its VP of Product, Mark Bagley, and Senior Director of Cybersecurity Strategy and Policy, Jonathan Reiber, will be along this week to talk about a couple of things. Mark will tell us why there's no magic validation program you can run to test your controls against ransomware actors, because basically they're too flexible. And Jonathan will talk through some angles on the Colonial Pipeline stuff. He served as the Chief Strategy Officer on Cyber Policy in the Office of the Secretary of Defense under the Obama administration. So yes, he does have some worthwhile opinions there. That is coming up later. But of course, it is time to talk about the week's news now with our co-host, Adam Boileau. And Adam, this week, we've just got to start with the aftermath of the Colonial Pipeline ransomware attack. I mean, it's mostly an event that has passed. The pipeline is back up and running.
Yes, they've started pumping gas around the place and, gradually supplies are starting to normalize in the US. There's been a little bit of reporting that they either did or didn't pay a ransom. That's somewhat
unclear. The reporting that they did pay it came from Bloomberg. We'll just say that. But yeah, no, not really clear whether, because there were reports that they paid $5 million and then denials, and it's kind of hard to know.
Yes, we've seen some reporting that appears to be based on blockchain evidence that there was a payment of $5 million. But of course, blockchain forensics is its own complicated set of things. But yeah, I mean, I think there did seem to be a little bit of confusion, and it seems like quite an important point, especially from a US policy point of view, which is kind of where this is now, where this is headed into, right? That once they've solved the basic can you pump gas, then really the policy fallout and the political fallout from it is important. And yeah, whether you paid a ransom kind of matters. But of course, then we also saw the complexity where the DarkSide ransomware crew appear to have had all of their Bitcoins taken away.
Yeah,
so no. Maybe they didn't pay the ransom to the right people, or maybe the ransom's gone somewhere else. Who knows?
Yeah. Now, this is an interesting thing, right? Because we've got two stories right here back to back. There's one from CyberScoop where Biden is saying, we're going to actually strike out at these guys. And then next minute, DarkSide, they lost access to all of their control panel and their hosting and their Bitcoin, and looks like they're having a bad time. And some people are saying this could be some sort of complicated ruse and they're just pulling the pin to lay low, but probably not if you had to guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of things it could be. It could be exit scam. Maybe it's a great time to get out of the business at the moment. You've made a bit of money, a little too much heat, time to run. Maybe it's, black hats on black hats. Maybe it's Cybercom, right? Who we don't really know whether or not they've, because there were some publications from the DarkSide crew saying, hey, we're kind of stopping what we're doing and, leaving everything be. But these groups form and reform and, there's individual people involved doing their own things. And there's always these kind of ties between other groups, over time as the market morphs. So we don't really know what's happened, but, clearly they're not business as usual.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the fallout from this in the sort of ransomware ecosystem, it's a little bit too early to gauge the impact, but we've already seen a couple of forums saying, no, we're not going to allow for, ransomware affiliate advertising and stuff on our forums anymore. So that's interesting. I think there seems to be a recognition in certain parts of the underground that maybe ransomwareing a critical pipeline was a step too far.
Yeah, it's certainly going to disrupt all of their other kind of operations. And I think, everyone is kind of afraid of a bit of an influx of, of law enforcement and spooks and whoever else, wants to get in and up in their business. So, yeah, maybe time to kind of cool things off a little bit. I don't think there's any suggestion that we'll see a taper off in ransomware as a result of this kind of thing. But as you say, it's too soon to tell. And we've seen stats pointing in both directions for, more or less ransomware.
Yesterday, I did an interview with an Australian politician, Tim Watts. He's a member of parliament. He's in the opposition party, the Labor Party, and he's the shadow minister for, I think, comms and cybersecurity. And it's interesting. I'm going to edit that together in the next few days and publish it. But this has certainly gone political. This has turned into what he described as a barbecue stopper, this issue. One thing you've got here is you've got Fox News and, Sean Hannity sort of barking at his viewers about how this is, what's Biden doing about this sort of thing. And you get the impression, I get the impression that the US government has to act pretty aggressively here, because every time there's another big ransomware incident, I do get the impression that, you know, all of the regular people on Fox are going to start using it to beat up the government with, right? So that's just a feeling I have, that this is now something where the US government is going to be held accountable.
Yeah, I think you're correct. And, you know, Americans are very sensitive about gas supplies. And it's just, you know, that's a thing that, you know, is going to apply pressure, even in a normal political climate. And then, you know, with the current state of American politics, you know, it's going to become a partisan sort of thing. And it absolutely will be used to, you know, kind of embarrass the Biden administration. And I'm sure he does want to, you know, kind of make a big statement, show that he's doing something. You know, the executive order that we talked about briefly last week, that's a step towards, you know, solving a whole bunch of problems that have, you know, have been there for a long time, but are also not fast to solve. And so, you know, it's going to be a political football for a while, I think, just because nothing in this sphere is easy.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get to talking about the EO in a minute. I mean, the TLDR on that one is everything that's in it is kind of what we expected to be in it. You know, there's this air crash investigations for cyber incidents sort of thing. There's like, but it's just sensible policy that you'd kind of expect. It's nothing radical. It's nothing that's going to rapidly shift the threat environment, right? But I think the only way we're going to be able to measure the impact of some of the offensive stuff that's no doubt taking place in the background, the only way we're going to be able to measure the impact of those sorts of initiatives is over time, right? And by observing the volume of activity. But so far, according to this piece from Rafael Satter at Reuters, you know, it looks like ransomware volumes are kind of back to business as usual already, this quickly after the Colonial Pipeline incident.
Yeah, I mean, sitting on things for a few days while it settled down isn't really, you know, hasn't really changed the overall trend of ransomware. And when you look at some of the numbers, and you know, now we're starting to get a better handle on how to track ransomware payments across the cryptocurrency infrastructure and that kind of thing. You know, some of those numbers are pretty sobering, you know, in the hundreds of millions of dollars a year, you know, heading to these crooks. And, you know, the trend lines are certainly terrifying. And yeah, a tiny little blip from this, you know, from people taking the week off and wondering how this was going to play out, didn't seemed like it made a whole bunch of difference.
Yeah, 90 million apparently DarkSide have made since October 2020. 90 million they've made. But I have a feeling, you know, it's going to cost them in some ways. Now, look, another ransomware incident we've been discussing over the last few weeks is this attack against the Washington, D.C. police. Attackers made off with 250 gigabytes of data and were threatening to release the data. The timeline's now passed and they have actually dumped that data.
Yeesh. And that's going to, you know, I imagine there's a lot of stuff in there that is going to, you know, have quite a long tail of problems for people, you know, in that part of the world as it gets dug through and disseminated and people figure out how to use it. You know, there's, you know, so many things you can do with that sort of data. And I'm, yeah, it's just a really, really shit situation for everybody involved, I think.
It is, but I'm surprised that the Babook crew decided that now was a good time to do this. Like, I'm honestly like, are you guys morons? What are you thinking?
It does seem like not the best kind of, you know, risk analysis. But hey, you know, we don't know how mature these operations are in terms of their own kind of, you know, risk modeling or, you know, what the structure of their organization, you know, allows for. You know, if it is a, you know, kind of affiliate situation, I don't know how the Babook crew works, but yeah, it doesn't. I mean, if it was me, I probably wouldn't, you know, maybe even just sit on it for a little while.
Take a month off.
Well, exactly, right? Exactly.
Now, look, we just touched on that EO briefly earlier. It's now dropped and it's got all of the stuff that we sort of expected in to go into it. Like, you know, vendors have to disclose breaches to their government customers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there's going to be more transparency in incident response, blah, 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 blah. People can check that out in this week's show notes. There's a Cyber Scoop right up of that, and you can click through and do all of the thing and actually read the order. I want to talk quickly about, and this is back on ransomware, sorry everyone. I want to talk quickly about this piece by Lily Hay Newman in Wired. And the headline is, "Ransomware's dangerous new trick is double encrypting your data." Now, the story itself, I mean, it's on the surface level, I mean, I didn't actually find it that interesting. But what it describes is that some ransomware crews are like, yeah, double ransomwareing people's data. And in some circumstances, they're sending two ransom notes at once. In other circumstances, you know, they're getting paid once and then saying, ha ha, tricked you. Now you've got to unlock us again. Now, one of the reasons ransomware crews have been successful is because they kind of have trustworthy brands. You know, if you pay, you're going to get your data back. It seems like this sort of thing is going to erode that. Another issue that I saw popping up in relation to the Colonial issue was even if they did pay, it was going to take them quite a while to actually bring their systems back online, even if they had the ability to unlock devices. So I sort of wonder if this is yet another threat to ransomware actors, which is that their ecosystem, their customer service is slipping, basically, is what I'm saying.
I mean, you're exactly, it's very correct, right? I mean, you do have to trust that you're doing the people you're doing business with. And okay, the business is extortion, but you still have to trust them. The idea that having two ransomware crews or two sets of ransomware operated by the same crew in the same environment, you know, in the end, the pool of money that someone's willing to pay probably is the same. And maybe you should have just asked for a bigger ransom with the one thing. That would seem smarter business to me. But yeah, this doesn't make a whole bunch of sense. And I can certainly see, you know, situations where we have, you know, an access broker selling access to a couple of different ransomware operators and then kind of doing it independently. But this is, you know, actual coordinated operations in the same environment, which just seems dumb. And as you say, doesn't serve their customer service interests.
Now, it was just last week that you and I discussed AXA Insurance's decision, the insurance company AXA. It made a decision to no longer pay out on ransomware claims in France. Next minute.
Yes, they've got themselves ransomwared in Southeast Asia. I think their operation in Thailand got compromised. A bunch of data stolen about the people, you know, their customers and things that were being insured, and then files ransomed. And that's not super great, in fact, if you're an insurer, because, you know, there's a lot of useful data there. Whether or not it's directly related, I mean, or rather,
probably
just,
not. Know, it's probably timing. Just a coincidence because everybody's getting ransomware.
Yeah, pretty much. But on the other hand, you can totally see, you know, some kids sitting there on access to Access Network sees the news and go, hey, I bet I could go sell this to the, you know, to a ransomware crew for the lols, and here we are. So, I mean, sometimes things are just that simple.
Guess what the next story is about?
Is it about ransomware?
I mean, it's crazy, isn't it, right? Like the amount of time we're spending on this, I mean, I can barely believe it. I feel sitting here in front of my microphone, I almost feel like it's become a bit farcical. Right? Particularly this year where it's just ransomware, ransomware, ransomware. But this next story, I mean, it's of such high impact that we can't ignore it. The Irish Prime Minister commenting on this because the Irish health system got hit big time.
Oh, yeah, the reporting is that the Conti ransomware crew hit the Irish, you know, health service executive, which is their public health system. And hospitals and stuff are shut down on the island and the whole country's health system's being held to ransom. I mean, this is just ludicrous. Like if this was a nation state turning off the hospitals of another nation state, you know, we wouldn't be having civilian conversations, right? We would be in acts of war, right? This is ridiculous.
Or if this were a terrorist group doing this in the name of the caliphate, for example, I don't think there'd be much of a discussion about whether or not to mobilize security services to do something about it. It's just farce. It's got to the point where it's farce.
It is, right? I mean, what's the point of a national government if not to protect its citizens' health and well-being, right? I mean, this is what we have, you know, collective government for, to protect us. So, and clearly if the hospitals are not working, then, you know, it's just what it's for. What are we doing?
Well, and it's happening in New Zealand as well, right? I believe this is just in one part of New Zealand, right?
Yeah, we had reports yesterday that one of our kind of regional health boards, you know, we're still talking a fifth of the country here, has hospitals are shut down, all the computers are off, phones are off because ransomware. There's some reporting that it may even be the same crew as in Ireland, although I'm not 100% sure, on that yet. But yeah, I mean, we're turning people away from hospitals when they need healthcare. What the hell?
Now, look, I'm going to refer to that interview I did with Tim that I haven't published yet, Tim Watts, the Member of Parliament here in Australia. There was one quote, and I played it to you before we got going this week, and he said, and I think quite reasonably so for a politician, he said, it's not like there's a magical release the hounds button that you can press that makes all of this go away. And, you know, you and I were talking about that just now, and I think maybe for people like Tim, and I think for a lot of people in the sort of policy world, they probably don't realize the extent to which a release the hounds button would make a sizable impact on this. You actually agree with me on that, don't you? You think that the offensive stuff that we've been sort of advocating here could make a sizable difference.
I mean, we have some pretty good hounds. They're sitting around, you know, doing useful work, I'm sure. But they have a whole range of tools and options, you know, that could be quite effective. And, you know, ransomware crews and cybercrime crews, you know, their OPSEC practices, their infrastructure management, their sysadmins, you know, their supply chains are all vulnerable in the same way that ours are. And in many cases are worse, right? They don't have the level of... You know, they have governance people and risk management people and stuff, right? I mean, we've been trying to get InfoSec right for a long time. These criminal organizations don't necessarily do that stuff right. There are a lot of hound-related options, you know?
Well, I mean, it's like when you think back to Silk Road, right? And when Silk Road was a big thing and everyone was like, wow, this person has managed to create a marketplace that is impenetrable. And then you talk to your friends over a couple of beers and, like, you know, half of our social group had got shell on Silk Road, right? So I think there's a bit of a – I think maybe policy people need a bit of a kick in the pants to understand that there are options here. I mean, if you were to – and, you know, you're an attacker. That's what you do for a living. If it was your job to disrupt these guys, how would you go about it?
Yeah, I mean, that would be a fun exercise.
That's a fun question for you. But, I mean, come on. Like, there's some pretty obvious first steps there. What would they be?
Yeah, I mean, you go after the communications and the trust and the building blocks of the community that they operate in. You
know, so take down the forums for starters, or at least hijack some accounts?
Yeah, forums, payment systems, messaging systems, the customer support systems, all the things that kind of glue the bits together. And then ideally you get yourself in a position to, you know, either intercept or man in the middle of those comms so that you can then choose which bits to interfere in. So understand the environment, do the recon, figure out who the people are, figure out what they're doing. Then you can degrade it. You can interfere with their trust, and then you can leverage what trust relationships there are there to go and figure out, you know, the individual people and individual systems that you need to break into, much like we would in a corporate environment, right? You do your reconnaissance, you figure out how they do their job, you watch them do it, and then you figure out how better to do it for them. And, you know, intelligence operations are pretty good at that kind of, you know, military planners always like to, you know, have everything arrive on target at in the right time in the right order. And if you get enough visibility, which, you know, we've got spook agencies that, you know, visibility is what they were originally built to do, getting all the pieces in place and then, you know, one swift strike, you take out a whole bunch of stuff all at once, leave everybody confused and afraid and scared. They turn on each other and you know, you slowed it down for a while.
And that is not pie in the sky stuff. And I think, you know, even some people in InfoSec, they have this line where offense isn't the solution here. It is. it is.
I mean,
I hate to say that there's a simple solution to a complicated problem, but I mean, it'd be shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're not going to solve the root cause issues, which is that, you know, the anomaly of cheap complexity. Like when you invoke Halvar on the subject, you've kind of ended the conversation because Halvar's always right. You know, we aren't going to solve that problem with offense, but the immediate problem of like the hospital in Hamilton, you know, in the North Island, New Zealand, isn't working. That problem, you know, we could go make some inroads into. And what the hell do I pay taxes for? And what are my spooks doing if not making the hospitals work?
Because, I mean, I think there's a misperception that these crews are somehow sort of the apex predators of the internet, and they're not.
Yeah, I mean, go back to the 90s Black Hat and Black Hat, then you'll see some goddamn apex predators, right? I mean, yeah. These guys, they got nothing on, you know, classic TISA and, you know, ADM and woo-woo.
No, but that's the thing. They're the Ross Ulbrichts of the cybercrime world, you know? Like, it's just, I don't understand. Anyway, I mean, I guess I feel like this is a bit different for us on this show. We don't normally just slide into, you know, 5 or 10 minutes of editorializing on a topic. But I do think, you know, it is time to pull out the stops. It is time to recognize the gravity of the situation. It's time to just give them hell, you know. And to anyone who's listening, who's been tasked to a team that's doing this stuff, happy hunting. All right.
And at the very least, we don't have to dedicate 20 minutes of every show every week to ransomware, you know, for the rest of time. Let's, you know, come on, help us.
At least
help
give us 5 minutes next week of talking about all the bad things that are happening to them. Anyway, we should Move on. Because now we enter the non-ransomware part of the show, and there's actually some good stuff to talk about here.
And the thing that I find particularly startling is here we are, we're halfway through the news segment, and we get to the, hey, there's a potentially wormable Windows IIS remote. Right? Can you imagine 5, 6, 7 years ago that not being the lead story?
And this headline just made me... I mean, I have been reporting... In July this year, I will have been reporting on InfoSec for 20 years. Right? 20 years. And nothing made me feel more nostalgic than this headline from Catalin Kimpanu: proof of concept released for wormable Windows IIS bug.
Yeah, it brings back good memories. It's like warm apple pie. That's what that is.
But look, yes. it's not actually as awful as the headline would have you believe. And explain to the listeners why.
Yeah, so I mean, the bug itself was awful. It's a Windows web server remote code exec, potentially wormable, which is nice, but only in very, very recent versions of Windows 10 and the equivalent Windows Server, and the kind of speed at which people deploy very, very modern Windows means there isn't a huge set of systems out there, and those systems typically are going to be getting patched very quickly because modern Microsoft Windows is good at patching itself. So not the planet melter that it would have once been if we were talking, IIS 6 remotes, as we were once upon a time.
Yeah, or IIS 4. Those were the days.
Yeah, good
remember when it was like, it was mostly IIS 4? Even after IIS 5 came out, people just didn't really upgrade, and it was just IIS 4 everywhere.
Yep, and a lot of people got a lot of shelled. And back then, getting shelled didn't matter because you didn't get ransomware.
Yeah, that's it. You got a Turkish hacker's rule defacement on a subdirectory that no one would look at.
No, like they'd stick themselves in zone H and that was the end of it, A picture of Bill Gates with the pie in the face and, job done. That's, it seems like a very much kinder, simpler time, doesn't it?
Yeah. We got another victim of the CodeCov breach. This time Rapid7 has come out and said some of their source code was accessed by the people who subverted CodeCov. I predicted this, I think last week or the week before, that there's going to be a bit of a drip, drip, drip of these for months to come.
Yeah, and I think you're right. Rapid7 had this CodeCov thing somewhere in the build pipeline of their managed detection response service. So attackers got in there, managed to help themselves, presumably to some creds, and then from there onwards to some source code. They are saying that was the extent of it, but yeah, you're right. We're going to see, as people figure out that the attackers have used this particular avenue. And attacking the supply chain of build pipelines is such a great technique, and it's so hot right now.
Another thing that's going to get you results is good old social engineering and catfishing, and apparently the Pakistanis are all over it.
Yeah, reporting here from Sean Lingus over at Cyberscoop is about Pakistani hackers using classic catfishing techniques to go after Indian military people, hit them up via email and social media and so on, and use that to compromise onwards into their systems. I think in return, the Indians have been doing much of the same sort of thing. I mean, that conflict between those two neighbors is certainly mirrored in the cyber world, and they've both got great capability for doing that sort of thing. But Pakistan's definitely been... their stocks have been going up in terms of their cyber capability over the years.
Well, speaking of, we've actually got a very interesting report here written by John Layden over at the Daily Swig, taking a look at North Korea and really how they're getting better and they're getting more brazen and they're getting more reckless.
Yeah, it's an interesting kind of wrap-up of, a bunch of the groups that operate inside North Korea and kind of how they fit together. Some of the changes over time in their, recklessness or their willingness to be detected. There's no doubt at all that North Korea's capability is pretty formidable, and they are clearly deployed in the interest of their national government because there's not much else you can do in North Korea. But, good kind of wrap-up of, what the current state of play of those actors and, their tasking is.
Yeah, well, I wonder if they're going to jump on the ransomware thing as well,
Well, I mean, I'm sure if it makes the money and they get a directive from their leader, then, off they go.
Yeah, we'll see. Now, this one from Dan Gooden over at Ars Technica, very interesting story. listeners would remember that some time ago in the city of Oldsmar, Florida, someone managed to log in via TeamViewer into a water treatment facility, of course, as you do, and attempt to put a really toxic dose of chemicals into the water there by interfering with the control system. Looks like Dragos has been in there trying to figure out what went wrong. By the looks of things, they haven't figured out exactly how that intrusion happened, but they found some other stuff that's actually a little bit alarming. So it's led to a very interesting story. Talk us through it.
It's super interesting. So they identified a watering hole attack that had been targeting people in the water treatment business, and someone from the Altima Florida Water facility had visited this water hole site that would collect a whole bunch of data, not actually go through and attack people, but was collecting a whole bunch of data, you know, about their browsers and their systems and so on, and then ferreting that off to some backend C2. And they went and pulled the thread on this, and they found something like 1,000 different end users in, you know, water-related facilities around the US had visited this watering hole during its operation. And there's no suggestion that the operators of this watering hole were then related to the intrusion in the water facility in Oldsmar, but the fact that they've kind of stumbled across a watering hole campaign so targeted to water treatment, pretty concerning.
Yeah, exactly. I just love it that they go to investigate the lame attack and then they see something quite serious, you know.
Well, exactly. And it goes to show, right? Once you start looking, you never know what you're gonna find. And yeah, there's some, I think, tie up with some other groups, you know, in terms of the some of the TDPs and ISCs involved with this particular watering hole. But I imagine Dragos will, you know, keep pulling this thread for a while, and we'll see some further write ups once they start to figure out, you know, kind of who it is and what's going on and how this relates to, you know, other activity, you know, whether it's in critical infrastructure or somewhere else.
Now, Catalan Campano, for the record, has a wonderful story here about a group of Brazilians who've been arrested in the United States. And these guys have been working hard on some – they've been working very hard on some pretty cool grift. I mean, it's the sort of scam that we've seen before involving like Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, that sort of stuff, spoofed GPS, fake accounts, like – but it's cool. Talk us through it. I love these sorts of grift rings for some reason. I always find them really interesting.
So this crew were basically signing up for accounts with various kind of, you know, gig delivery services like Uber and Lyft and so on, and then renting those accounts out to other people who wouldn't have otherwise been able to get them. So that's kind of part one of the scam. They take a cut from, you know, the poor Lyft driver's already meager earnings for the privilege of driving for Lyft. And then there was also some technical aspects where they were, you know, doing identity theft to steal the identities to go and make these accounts and use GPS to make some of the trips be, you know, longer or shorter or what, you know, whatever kind of made the money in this ecosystem. You know, of course, the fraud detection at Uber, I think, managed to spot some weird stuff going on and pull the thread and led to the downfall of this particular group. But what's interesting is that it really does seem like a lot of work for not a whole bunch of money. I mean, in the order of, you know, a couple of $100,000 or so here and there for some of the people, for what really does look like a lot of work to me.
Yeah, I think one of them, there was a screenshot posted in the group's WhatsApp channel, and one gang member apparently earned about $200,000 via DoorDash's user referral system for 487 accounts they had on the platform. But look, we don't know what the totality is here. I mean, that's just one number in the story. They could have made a fair bit, you know?
I mean, absolutely, they could have. And I guess, you know, this kind of very niche, you know, very niche crimes, you know, there is opportunity in them. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of funny places where, you know, if you can get your scan, get your grift just right, you can, you know, make enough to, you know, keep you in Dom Perignon or whatever Brazilian criminals are into. I don't know.
Nice caipirinhas and picanha. It looks like also they did a big pivot from the ride-sharing side of things, which is where they were, to the DoorDash side when COVID hit. So, you know, love that sort of agile innovation. The operator of WeLeak Info has been sentenced to 2 years in prison, and I saw that headline and I thought, geez, that's pretty lenient. And then I saw that he was sentenced in the Netherlands, not the United States, which explains why he's not in prison for the next 15 years.
Yeah, I think there's three people involved in running this site, which publicized kind of existing breach data, but would give you the actual passwords and things.
It was like the evil twin to Have I Been Pwned, would actually give you the passwords instead of just telling you if there was a password in the thing.
So they, I think, arrested three people. Arrested two people. The third one is still, you know, at large. And this is one of the ones, the guys that was doing, like, the data entry, was responsible for taking the incoming dumps and, you know, piping through grep and cut and awk to try and, you know, load them up into the database, which does not sound like a glamorous way to pass your time. And 2 years in jail for, you know, operating a Unix text processing pipeline. I mean, you know, maybe that's a reasonable punishment.
He's going to do 1 year, second year on probation. But it does sound a bit harsh if you're just the admin, basically. Like, you know, they're just doing a job. But I don't know. It was illegal. So there's that.
Illegal. And I mean, some of the chat logs that got publicized did make them sound like kind of dicks. So, yeah. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Joe Cox has a, you know, more reporting on his favorite topic, which is around location data at the moment. This time he's looking at some of the political pressure being applied to the Pentagon by Ron Wyden, who is asking, hey, you know, are you buying data that also, you know, happens to have bundled with it data on American citizens? This is tracking Americans without a warrant, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So just more reporting on this issue from him.
Yeah, Wyden has been asking questions of the Pentagon, you know, around what third-party services. We've seen this kind of trend with some of Joe's reporting, you know, on a number of these kind of data aggregators that then sell onwards access. Some of that's to, you know, government services. So Wyden's been asking the Pentagon for, you know, who they buy data off, what the data is, how they establish that it's not targeting Americans when clearly it does. And some of the answers that have come back have been classified. And so the reporting now is that, you know, Wyden's encouraging the Pentagon to declassify some of that information so that it can be talked about more publicly. And I mean, I guess, you know, this is still useful stuff, but really kind of what the US needs is to deal with privacy and the concept of these commercial data brokers will stop, because obviously the government using it is one bad thing that can happen, also potentially a good thing, I guess, in some cases. But there's so many other ways that data can be used and abused, and, you know, better privacy is, I guess, you know, where this will end up going, rather than dealing with the specifics of what the Pentagon are doing.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to have to be some sort of oversight on all this stuff, or at least some sort of process, some sort of review. Does it need to be judicial oversight? Does it need to be DOJ? Like, they've got to work it out, because it can't continue like this. They've got to figure something out, is what I'm getting
at. Yes, yeah, it's certainly a big old mess at the moment. And, you know, not, I don't think, you know, the people who've been pulling this thread aren't going to let go. So, yeah, they're going to have to come up with something.
Joe's colleague Lorenzo Franceschi Bicarai, over at also over at Vice, has been writing a bunch of stories about Apple's AirTags. Fun stuff, though. Fun stuff.
Yeah, this has been interesting, you know, watching the research community pull these devices that Apple have released apart and try to understand, you know, the technical aspect. These are, if you haven't seen them, they are kind of like little self-contained radio device, like radio tracking devices that you can stick on your stuff, and then they beacon out, and every other iPhone in the world will listen for it and report it back to Apple. And it's quite an interesting system, because it's built in a way that's designed to preserve privacy and designed to be kind of robust against a bunch of the abuses you would first think of, which is quite good. I mean, obviously Apple has put, you know, security as, you know, part of their proposition to the market, and they're trying to kind of deliver on that with the AirTags. And so watching researchers pull apart the technical aspects of that, and also the kind of, you know, how the system works and what other things you can abuse it for. So there's been some great stories about, you know, people essentially kind of jailbreak and get to the point where they can dump the firmware off the devices through some power glitching attacks to bypass the debug protections in the embedded microprocessor, you know, through to things like using the listening network of iPhones to deliver data out of band, you know, from environments that don't have direct internet access, through to kind of understanding how these things could be misused for, you know, tracking other people or whatever else, you know, you might do with a location-aware device. So, yeah, really interesting, you know, interesting to see the whole different set of things that, you know, people are thinking about to do with these.
Yeah, I think it's inevitable, though, that this type of technology is going to become pretty pervasive in coming years. And, you know, there will be drawbacks, particularly around privacy and tracking and stuff like that. But we're just going to have to eat them, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I think so. And it's kind of interesting that we're seeing, you know, the first mover in this market be Apple and lead in a way that does at least have some consideration of privacy and security. Whereas if we saw it from another vendor, we might not. You know, if Amazon sold one of these first, you kind of get the feeling that it probably wouldn't have robust protections for, you know, using it for stalking people, for example.
What are the protections that Apple have put in here to prevent it from stalking people?
So they've got a couple of things. One of them is, you know, if you've got an Apple device and someone has slipped one of these AirTags, you know, into your handbag, it will detect that there is a tag moving in the same place as your phone, so it's following you around, and then eventually it will tell you about that. They say, hey, there's someone else's AirTag is following you, or, you know, you're carrying it around. Did you know? And eventually, if you can't find it, it will start beeping. It'll start making a noise, a little chirping thing, so that you can kind of locate it and find it. So giving people some of the tools to be able to know that it's following them and be able to then take some action. And there's a few other things where you can, you know, go and identify the device if you find it. Bits like that. It's not obviously not perfect. There are a bunch of ways that you know, people can abuse the technology, but the fact that they've thought of that at all is above average.
Yeah, no, definitely is. Look, we're going to turn our attention here to some pretty hardcore research into AMD's so-called SEV virtual machine protection system. You know, I'm guessing this is just more of the same stuff where a CPU architecture is promising some sort of ability to do confidential computing and it doesn't really work the way it's supposed to. Have I got it about right?
Yeah, that's basically it. So AMD have some technology where hypervisors can have virtual machines that are running within it, where the hypervisor operating system doesn't have access to the key material, which is encrypting the RAM and disk of the virtual machine. So the idea is that your cloud service provider could be less trusted, I guess. The idea is that you don't have to trust them, but I mean, obviously just less trusted, I guess, is what we're aiming for. And there's been some vulnerabilities in the cryptographic mechanisms used to enforce this, whereby the hypervisor and kind of like shuffle encrypted blocks around that are still encrypted and not change the contents of them, but by reordering them, cause a virtual machine protected by this mechanism to execute arbitrary code provided by the hypervisor, bypassing this particular set of protections. And this is a technology that AMD introduced a few years ago in the kind of data center centric processor lines. And the fix for this really is to use their more modern one that was only released in last year, I think. And if you're running the older version, the older AMD EPYC CPUs in your cloud, then there's really not much you can do about it, which is a difficult place to be. But I think this was still a pretty niche service. And I don't know that anyone would at the moment want to rely on it as the sole thing to protect you from your cloud provider. You do at the moment still have to trust them, and I think that's going to be the case for a while, you know, even with, you know, these controls getting better.
Yeah, it's funny because I had an old colleague, a former colleague of mine from many, many, many years ago, actually get in touch with me, a journalist, and who was asking me about this, you know, sort of topic, which is about confidential computing and where's it at. And I was just sort of, I sort of made Marge Simpson noises about it, basically was my, you know, that's sort of where we are with that. We're going to finish this week's news segment by doing something we don't often do. We're going to praise Microsoft.
So Microsoft have released a bunch of playbooks for incident responders to try and go through and go for companies to go through the incident response process to kind of understand, you know, what to do in a particular event. And they've got a number they've released so far. For example, you know, dealing with phishing, another one dealing with Microsoft 365, like application authorization, application consent, you know, when you've consented to an untrustworthy app and it can go off and do things. So they've got you know, playbooks that walk through the tools and techniques you'd need to be able to investigate, the level of access you need, and the steps you go through to be able to pull the data together to figure out what happened and what to do about it. And that's really, really useful, especially when it's you know, if it's something like phishing, that's pretty generic, I guess. We understand, you know, how to deal with phishing in our own environments. But when it's something as specific as consent, you know, abuse in 365, having some guidance from Microsoft about how to investigate that and what to think about is very, very useful. And it sounds like this is the beginning of kind of a series of these that they're going to publish. That seems really helpful.
It does. Well, Adam, we're actually done. It's actually been a shorter than usual news discussion this week, which rarely happens these days. But look, that was all very interesting stuff. And it's been a pleasure to chat to you as always. And we'll pick it up again next week.
Yeah, thanks so much, Pat. Talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Mark Bagley and Jonathan Reiber from Attack IQ. Attack IQ, of course, makes software that you can use to test the effectiveness of your security controls. It is attack simulation and control validation software, and you can find them at attackiq.com. And I thought it'd make sense to ask them about a couple of things. Jonathan Reiber has experience as a cyber strategist at the Office of the U.S. Defense Secretary under the Obama administration. So I asked him about how he thinks this whole colonial thing will shake out. But we started off this session by asking Mark Bagley, who is Attack IQ's VP of Product, if there's a particular type of attack simulation you can do to better protect yourself against ransomware crews, you know, to test your controls against the TTPs that they exhibit. Unfortunately, there isn't really, because those attackers are actually pretty flexible in how they roll. So you really need to have all of your ducks in a row, not just some of them. So here's Mark Bagley kicking off this sponsored session with Attack IQ.
I would agree with that assertion that there is no cheat code. But the good news is that we have the technology today available to us all to continuously assess whether or not our controls are in defensible shape.
Yeah.
We can understand what our posture is versus these adversaries. We don't have to guess.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a good point, right? But it's hard, right? Because in a typical enterprise computing environment, there's no real one thing you can do, is there, to defeat these guys? Because they do exhibit pretty flexible TTPs.
Well, they're flexible and they adapt to their target. And, you know, even the average crews with, you know, toolkits that they've lightly modified on their own are crafting their exploits to start, but they're crafting their exploits to start from the same basis that everyone else is working from, because the net sum of adversary behaviors can be quantified. And that's the beauty of MITRE ATT&CK. That's why we can now describe what they're doing in a common language, and from enumerating your defensive response to all of those TTPs, now you're in control of knowing what your program will do and being able to describe how you need to improve it or tune it over time.
Jonathan Reiber is also with us. Jonathan, I know you've been watching the whole Dark Side Colonial thing. Look, as we're recording this, Colonial's just announced that they're going to have their pipeline up and running again. I think they've just restarted it. In fact, you think this is a bit of a watershed moment. You did hear our interview with Chris Krebs that ran in last week's show. You think this is going to be a shakeup for the critical infrastructure sector? I mean, you've got a history in government as well. I mean, we've thought that in the past, right? We've thought that this, you know, that certain events would actually lead to change, and they kind of haven't. Why is it different this time?
Well, hope springs eternal, Patrick. I mean, that's the first thing. Different, you know, always a new investment in hope, right? No, I think that this is, I think it's a different moment. You know, my first response when this happened is this is a scenario that the government's been preparing for quite some time, right? That's the first thing. And so the difference is the population is being affected in a way psychologically that's profoundly different from everything I would say, except for perhaps the Russian government's intrusion into the 2016 election, which was like a very clear catalyzing moment across sectors. So if we account for human psychology, I would bet that this is actually going to lead to increased spending by critical infrastructure owners and operators, because Americans saw the shift at the gas pump, right? You saw a 2% rise this week. Who knows by the time the show airs what will have changed. But if you take a step back and think about the psychology of threats, right? Daniel Gilbert at Harvard, he ran this great analysis. He said, why is it that humans respond to terrorism well, but not climate change? And part of it is you feel the threat acutely, it's proximate, and you have like, it's easy to rally your brain to make sacrifices and come up with solutions to solve climate change.
I'm just so happy to hear you talking about this incident through that lens, because I feel like I'm taking crazy pills when you see so many people saying, oh, this isn't a watershed moment, this isn't a big deal. This is the sort of thing that a politician in leadership is going to take action on, because people feel scared. Now, you can argue about whether or not they're right or wrong to feel scared. You can argue about whether or not they're right or wrong to be filling up jerry cans and throwing them in the back of their SUVs. The point is, if you make a sizable portion of a population in a region scared that they're not going to be able to fill up their car in a few days, that is a problem that leadership has to address. But that's, I guess, right. What you're saying, though, is that critical infrastructure are going to take this seriously. I'm skeptical on that. I think politicians will take this seriously, but I think, you know, things like pipelines, it's such a low margin game that I don't know that they can actually really ramp up the spend that they need to.
So let's think now. Like, this is the third major incident in what feels like a week, but it's probably 3 months, right? You have SolarWinds, then you have Microsoft Exchange, then you have this. Each one under the narrative of the coronavirus, we're a society that's already under duress and is vulnerable and feeling the stresses and strains.
It's a multiplier for fears, right? Like, yeah, no question,
for sure.
No question. And I think a lot of the gasoline hoarding kind of ties back into that whole toilet paper thing from last year. And it's 100%. Just that there's a bit of a hypervigilant mentality among everyone, right? So I see what you're saying.
Right. So what I think, at least from as a security strategist, and this reminds me of my time in particular in government, like, you want to come up with logical clarity. You want to have visibility and you want to have control as much as you can if you're an organization. Now, let me walk through just really briefly, like, what the government's response might, what we might begin to see. Folks have talked about disruptive capabilities. You talked about this last week. You wanting more offensive capabilities, finding linkages between criminal groups and states that may be harboring them or not imposing costs on them, which is like, there's like a scale probably of like passive permissiveness versus enabling and funding. There's very different. So I think we'll see a range of investments in disruptive capabilities. But the problem really is that the intelligence community and the military cannot solve for years, I've thought we could bankrupt the Treasury by investing in the cyber mission force and the intelligence community with the hopes that we're going to blunt and disrupt all these kinds of attackers. But the fact is, with commodity ransomware and with weapons becoming more affordable all the time on the market, smaller groups of people can acquire them for cheap. And so what it actually, the economic transition is, it shifts the onus back onto the private sector. And that's actually right, because the intelligence community in the US cannot have control over critical infrastructure. It's impossible to scale, but we also, more importantly, have like civil liberties and privacy concerns that abut it. So when you think about visibility, which is something that General Nakasone has talked about, and also Ann Neuberger spoke about it in her SolarWinds briefing, like, the visibility we're talking about is the private sector needs visibility into its security controls, like what actually exists within its arsenal. And then it needs to have visibility into how well those things perform. If you don't know what you have and you don't know how well they're performing, you exist in a state of complete opacity. And in a state of opacity, it leads to chaos because you cannot maintain control. So the first step to take, and we know this through SolarWinds because I've spent a lot more time thinking about SolarWinds than anything else lately, is like, you run an emulation against your security controls. And you, like, if you run lateral movement against your security controls in November and you're the Department of the Treasury, you're going to see the intruder moving laterally throughout your data center, like wreaking havoc. So it's very clear that if you invest in like a security segmentation capability to prevent lateral movement, then you've stopped at least one of the tactics. So what Mark was talking about earlier is like, if you're running these emulations, and we know that the tactics and techniques that ransomware user, that these criminal groups are deploying through ransomware, then you're covering your known knowns, right? This is a known known. And you can solve your unknown unknowns by seeing how well your security program performs. So that's where I think like, to solve for this problem of confusion and stress, like, people are going to start moving towards wanting more visibility and control. And that's ultimately what I think the MITRE ATT&CK framework helps you do and what automated security control validation does in practice.
Sure. I mean, I do want to pick you up though on the idea that this is like, I agree that it's a watershed moment. I agree that change here is desirable, but I don't think it's going to come without regulation simply by nature of these being very low margin businesses, right? That don't have the sort of spare cash lying around you'd expect to stand up a comprehensive security program that's going to take care of, in this case, something like a 5,000-mile pipeline. Like, I just sort of do fear that we're a little bit stuck here, and without a government coming in and forcing these organizations to spend the money, which is going to result in price hikes, let's be clear, it will result in price hikes. And that's, you know, and that's a line of attack that is then opened up on the government of the day, right? The opposition can come in and say, look at these clowns. What they've done is they've implemented this, crazy over-regulation that's resulting in higher gas prices. So, I mean, I'm just wondering how you think that whole thing is going to play out, because the politics meets the business meets the economics of this. Even that side of it is pretty complicated.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I still carry the scars of trying to get cybersecurity legislation passed in the 2010, 2012 timeframe, when we had things like a mandate that we'd initially tried to bake in, the security community was in one place, at least within the first round of negotiations within the Obama White House, the entire security community wanted a mandate. And the commerce and the economic side was like no mandate. So that it ended up being voluntary standards. And even that failed to get past the legislature. Now, that was a very different time. We're talking like 11 years ago.
Well, that's like tying that back to what we were talking about earlier. All of a sudden, you've got gas stations running out of product. You've got people scared. You've got it on cable news. It's a scary Russian crew, you know, like that whole thing. I mean, and I guess that's the key question here, which isn't a question about security technology. It's a question about politics. Do you think that this event has swung public perception to the degree that it needs to give license to politicians to actually start doing, you know, heavy-handed regulation on this stuff, which is ultimately the only thing that's going to work?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very bullish on legislation, right? Like, I was an advisor on the Cybersecurity Solarium project, and I saw the sheer number of legislative proposals that they baked in that then got through Congress, through bipartisan support under Rep. Gallagher and Senator King, right? Like, these guys have shaped how Congress gets things done. And Jim Langevin was there before either one of them, right? Like, working on this ages ago. So I'm bullish on our legislature in particular, because there's also like associated but different pressures coming from a regulatory environment for the tech sector overall, coming out of the social media dystopia that we live in. Like, there's this emergent, and there's some who want to resist that part of it, but there's a lot of consensus around cybersecurity. And I think coming out of, as I said, the last three intrusions that have happened in the last what feels like an afternoon, but is actually 2 months or maybe 1,000 years, the society is more willing to make these sacrifices. I think Mark Warner has done great work. Like, coming out I firmly believe coming out of GDPR that it's a question of not if but when the U.S. passes a comprehensive privacy breach.
It just has to happen. But I think, you know, the two key words in this whole thing, right, which is like America's trigger words, if you will, energy security, right? No one has really given a shit about cybersecurity, but they do give a shit about energy security. I mean, that's a two-word combo that DC takes pretty seriously.
What did you call it? The Operation Internet Liberation?
Yeah, Operation Internet Liberation. Yeah. Is the sort of mobilization we could see. But I mean, what do you think about that, Jonathan? Do you think the fact that this is now an energy security issue is just a complete game changer? Because time will tell, but that's my sense. I think if anything was going to change the perception of this issue within government circles inside the Beltway, this has got to be it.
The only time I've ever gotten anything right on cybersecurity was when I predicted that the Iranian regime would do a counterstrike for Stuxnet. I knew that was the only time I've ever gotten anything right. And I'm going to stick with that only, because I feel like if I try and wager out into the prognostication department, I'm destined to fail. The only thing I could say with confidence is that I feel certain that because of the acuteness of it, and it could have been anything, it could have been a healthcare problem, but the problem is that there's no national healthcare system in the US, right? Like, if this had been a national healthcare disruption.
See, that occurred to me as well, right? Because you had all these hospitals going down, you had the DC police going down, like all of this stuff. I think if you had have had an entire state's health system here in Australia affected, it would have been taken extremely seriously. I think because the health system in the United States is so fragmented, that's why it didn't really register as a national issue.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, if you look at the map of the pipeline, and it crosses like all the original states plus, right?
Well, and it's red states, it's blue states, it's everyone. Yes. I mean, it's like if you wanted to just engineer an incident to piss off America, like, you've got everything. You've got oil, you've got southern states, you've got northern states. It's like, it's the perfect alignment of future enemies if you're these guys. Like, it was so stupid.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I think Congress is probably going to look for areas where everyone can work together, because there's so many areas where they disagree. And cybersecurity became in the last cycle this great area for bipartisan cooperation analytically, even when people would diverge on much more like lightning rod political issues. So I would be hopeful that this would lead to some change. The other part of it is that the Department of Energy, it's not like the Department of Energy and NERC and FERC haven't been thinking about this kind of situation forever. Right. So, like, there's tons of analysts who can come to you and be like, these are all the different regulatory options I propose and policy options. Like, here you are. So there's tons of good thinking on it. And now there might be like a mini watershed that we're like, could lead to, you know, these new ideas, the old ideas that get brought out again. That would be very positive.
That was Jonathan Reiber of Attack IQ there and Mark Bagley before him. Big thanks to them for that, and big thanks to Attack IQ for being this week's Risky Business sponsor. And that is it for this week's show. I'll be back soon with that interview with Tim Watts, probably tomorrow, maybe the day after. We'll see how I'm feeling. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.